Untangle Your Story with Sherry Doyen. Go beyond survival and discover the magic of thriving from childhood abuse. Join us every week as our stories and wisdom helps you create strategies to move you beyond surviving to thriving. You were meant to live a life worth living. And now, your host, Sherry Doyen.
Thanks for tuning in to Untangle Your Story. I'm your host, Sherry Doyen. Our mission here is to share our stories and our wisdoms to help you create strategies to find that strand of the story that's uniquely yours. Our goal is to help you move from a mindset of merely surviving into a life worth living. 35 million kids in the U.S. are experiencing at least one or more of the four forms of abuse. That's half of our children in the U.S. In sharing our stories, little by little, we chip away at that taboo that surrounds our experiences. Today, I'm excited to have with us Richard Grannon. His life experiences, his field of study, have culminated in this much-needed change in thought around the process of moving into a fulfilled life. He spent years walking people through this process through his coaching practice, but now has developed a simple, concise course for you to work with at home, the Overcoming Narcissistic Abuse Course. Richard, hello. Thanks for being here and your willingness to have this conversation.
Thank you very much for having me. It's very kind of you to invite me in.
First, can you share a little bit about you and all the letters behind your name?
Originally, I was a graduate in psychology, and I had an interest in finding out a little bit more about applied psychology, so I looked at different styles of therapy. So I was doing a lot of research outside of my degree course as well. And then I moved into teaching people self-defense, martial arts, and self-protection. And then that slowly evolved over the period of about a decade into trying to get into the roots of why people experience abuse and what the effects of abuse are on the human mind and their emotions.
And it's well overdue. Thank you for that. And did you have a history? Was that something that kind of, pushed
yes.
you in that direction with your study? You came from there?
Yes, I did. Throughout childhood, I was exposed to quite a bit of violence and different types of abuse, emotional, psychological, and physical. And then in my early teens, I experienced some ongoing sexual abuse. That sent me in a certain direction. But I think I spent, like a lot of people who are survivors of sexual abuse, a lot of years in denial. And I think I got very into martial arts as a sort of protection, as an armor against that, without ever really looking at the vulnerability and how I actually felt about the experiences that I've been through.
Because, I think we're just running on the inside, right? We're just running, and you never look back when you're running. So you're only dealing with what's right in front of your face.
Absolutely.
Right?
Absolutely.
Now, I know you you studied the process of NLP. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think I was looking for something that was a bit outside the box. I found traditional psychotherapy a little bit rigid and a little bit stuffy and a bit judgmental as well. So I started to look at NLP because it had that pioneering, curious, rebellious spirit to it, which I liked. And so I was lucky enough to actually, when I was about 18, I qualified as a practitioner of NLP. And I actually was lucky enough to train with one of the founders of NLP, Richard Bandler.
Well, that's amazing. That's amazing. I know with myself, I also had ongoing sexual abuse, three abusers, and physical violence and all that as well. And I know that my years of traditional therapy left me in a place of barely treading water, right? And
yes.
Yeah. So, this is a very much needed. I'd like for you to talk about that space a little bit, between surviving and living, if you don't mind.
Sure. I mean, one of the things that is probably worth addressing within that, within your question as well, is that a lot of well-meaning clinicians and therapists who have the best of intentions, they don't really understand how trauma functions, and they don't really understand how the human mind functions and how emotions interact with each other. And so we have this deconstructive model that we use where we think of the human being as like a machine. And if you can just pull them apart, then they will heal. Of course, that isn't how it works, and it can actually be a very deeply re-traumatizing experience just to go through classical therapy. And in order to get from a place where we are just surviving to actually thriving and living again, the kind of healing that needs to be done is very precise, very subtle, and really requires a specialist expertise.
Because it's a process. I mean, I found through myself, I never found therapists that functioned on that level. And, you know, I just kind of traveled the U.S. touching spiritual, you know, and I kind of came from that place, the spiritual realm as far as my healing. How do you kind of feel there? Did you touch there as well? Or?
Yes, I did for years. When I was growing up, I was in so much pain. I consumed a hell of a lot of literature from a lot of different sources. And, you know, in the 90s, I was an adolescent, and I was reading, you know, Louise L. Hay and Wayne Dyer and Deepak Chopra, studying a lot of Zen Buddhism and a lot of New Age type philosophy. I was ingesting a lot of that. As the years went by, less and less so. And, you know, as I actually managed to... The problem was that I couldn't see what the core issue was, so I didn't really know how to find a solution for it. Once I'd managed to define what the core issue was, it became much clearer how to find a solution for that.
Now, did you have amnesia? Did you remember?
I can't remember if I have amnesia. Ha ha. No, there are blank spots for sure. There's I did in my own therapeutic experience. I was told to journal, and I did some journaling, read back the journals, and I became convinced for a while that somebody else had hacked my computer and written those journals, not me. So I saw firsthand my own delusion, psychological blind spots, and a kind of psychosis, really, which was the type of thing I thought only really existed in movies. I thought that's just a dramatic idea that people just block out totally whole sections of their life. But I saw it in black and white, as it were, that I really was doing that.
Oh, I experienced the same thing. Mine came crashing through with my first pregnancy. And I really had no memories of my childhood at all. You know, I was always just looking ahead. So all of a sudden, I was, you know, every time I fell asleep, I was having dreams.
Yes.
You know, and what a time, right? You're having this beautiful experience and infusing all this fear into your child.
It seems to be the way, doesn't it? It's a very provoking experience when you yourself actually become a mother and those biological changes are going on inside of your own body. People reconnect with what it is to be a parent, and it really deeply seems to affect their self-identity, and it really sifts up a lot of stuff from the bottom of the unconscious. So yeah, I'm not surprised to hear that at all.
Well, I think from a layperson's perspective, it's very much like those memories were very needed at that moment for me to not carry the cycle forward. You know, up to that point, I don't know that I could have processed. You know, I there were so many years and layers of abuse there. I'm not sure my psyche could have handled it. It's like my information kind of came to me as I needed to deal with what was in front of me.
Right, right. Yeah, I think the mind will do that. You know, it will protect itself, and as an operational machine for survival, it will sort and do triage and say, okay, well, this is too much. We can't deal with this right now, but this is enough. I can process this, and this, but this big thing over here, I'm not going to look at that. And it does make sense. It has its own logic.
Right. And, you know, I also, in my conversations with people, it seems like the younger that they bump up against all this incongruence, the more adept they become at disassociating and kind of maneuvering that thought in a weird, odd way, right? Because, I mean, I you know, we have the sociopathic thought, we have the narcissistic thought. Usually there's alcohol and drugs involved mm-hmm. there, and you've got a child trying to maneuver that.
Absolutely, and that's the perversion of this whole thing is it forces us into a position where we as the end up usually being boundary broken, codependent people pleasers who are trying to fawn and please these extremely toxic, demanding and exploitative personalities. But we become like them to a degree in certain subtle ways. And one of them is this huge denial, which you've already mentioned. And the other one is our own mental manipulations. In order for a narcissist to remain a narcissist, they have to tell themselves a story about themselves and who they are that isn't true in order to survive. But the codependent has to do the same thing. We
well,
are
I
very,
think they're very adept
become,
in pushing that self-doubt button.
Definitely.
Right? Like,
definitely.
I mean, I know for myself, I lived feeling like I was the crazy one.
Yes, that button, unfortunately, for people like us is very big and bright and shiny and obvious to the exploitative personality, and they can push that at any moment. They can see it, they can hit it, and they know that they can spiral you into shame and guilt and self-doubt very easily.
Yeah, and kind of a shift in thought. I like to look back and think, wow, what a cool kid, right, that you know, the ingenuity, you know, with which they maneuvered those situations and the, you know, I mean, for myself, I mean, I was such an empath because I had to be, right? I had to be able to feel what you were feeling to be able to mm-hmm. diffuse the situation. And I don't think we realize our magic a lot of times in that how many situations did we diffuse?
Yes.
With our gifts, telepathy, you know. I mean, and as adults, we look at all that as dysfunction. Oh, she's hearing voices, she's this, she disassociates, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, well, you know, what's the difference between disassociation and astral travel? What's the difference between hearing voices and channeling and telepathy?
I think for a lot of the kids who are raised in an environment where there was abuse, whether it was physical or emotional, they do grow up to be very gifted and very driven and also quite self-destructive. And that would describe, like, I'm sure there's a ton of, like, our favorite musicians, our favorite stand-up comedians, our favorite, you know, whatever it happens to be, will often fall into that category. And it's usually because these survival skills that they learned as children, that they were forced to learn as children, they turn into a virtue. The problem comes in later life where they don't face that vulnerability, they don't face that pain, and the self-destruct button is still sort of pushed on, as it were.
It was very powerful for me to look back and realize that spiritually all the things I was trying to learn, very many of them, I could use it. I already could do as a child. But,
right.
You know, there's that hitting with the world and realizing, you know, hey, the average person doesn't hear voices.
Yeah.
Or the average person doesn't just leave their body and do whatever. You know what I mean?
Yes.
Can you talk to that a little bit?
Yeah, there's, I wish I could remember the lady's name. There's a really good TED Talk that's available on YouTube if the listeners want to check it out. That's actually called, I think it's called Talking to the Voices in My Head, by a lady who addresses that, like there is a function to what we would be taught to do in psychotherapy and in modern Western medicine would be to suppress the voices, to switch them off, to medicate them, and to just treat it as a kind of psychosis, rather than actually looking at those voices and saying, well, what's the communication? What's the purpose of the dialogue? Don't assume that the unconscious mind is necessarily giving you a destructive message. There could be something positive in that. So that's
very
important.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Yes, I love that.
So there is a kind of implicit self-disrespect that psychotherapy accidentally puts in there because it doesn't acknowledge the internal experience of that human being. And acknowledging the internal experience is exactly what they need in order to heal. They need that internal experience acknowledged and validated and told it's okay. these things are okay, you're okay for thinking that, feeling that it's okay, and to not be judged for that.
Yeah, and I think it's very powerful to acknowledge, because I think that any gift we have, when we're suppressing it, we're not recognizing it, it begins to use us. And yes. I felt like that's where I kind of got, you know, was in my denying my voices, I got to where I couldn't hardly be in a group of people, you know?
Right.
And in learning as an adult how that you know, switching that thought from being a dysfunction to a gift was very powerful mm-hmm. for me. And deciding, hey, I'm going to learn how to use this, right? I'm going to learn how to, you know, put up some tethers to where I can decide when to use it.
Absolutely. I mean, it's the basic principle that will help people to move forward. And there's great systems of therapy that are based just in that idea of acknowledging what's going on. There's a lady called Connie Ray Andreas who wrote a book called Core Transformations. Her roots are in NLP, but the work that she did ended up being very, very deeply therapeutic with her book Core Transformations. And that is all about looking at how the different parts of a person can be in conflict. And sometimes these inner voices can be parts of the individual self that is splintered, that are trying to communicate and even fight with each other, and how listening to that communication and mitigating some of that inner conflict and mediating it can actually lead to a more fulfilling life, which makes
no,
it makes
I
a lot
love
of sense
that.
To me.
I love that. But, you know, I think that there's kind of a trend about naming these parts, and I'm sorry, if somebody would have named my parts, and they became that clear of an identity, I don't know that I would ever have been able to wind them back together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, because yeah. I felt like it was more like a split end, right? Like it's a strand of emotion that just got mm-hmm. severed, and we need to grow that piece up. But I don't like the idea of giving it its own complete space. How mm-hmm. do you feel about mm-hmm. that?
I think it depends on in a clinical sort of like a coaching setting for me, I would be saying, well, what's the objective and what's the experience that you're going through? And what is it? How are you defining this? What's the metaphor that's being used to define what's going on? And really looking at that first and foremost, because if the coach or the therapist is coming from one model of reality and the client is coming from a different one, you'll never be able to meet them in their world. And ultimately,
right.
the coach or the therapist has to meet the client in their world, not force them into some other reality that's not theirs, that is some sanitized idea of what it means to be mentally healthy, whatever that may or may not mean, but to meet the client in their world and operate from there.
I love that. I know that for myself, I spent a lifetime chasing normal, you know, trying mm-hmm. to fit into that space. And, you know, in the end, I was like, well, normal means average. Is that where mm-hmm. I really want to stand? You know, maybe mm-hmm. I'm abnormal in a cool way.
Yeah, I think I'm a little bit of a conspiracy theorist, and I do think that there probably was an effort to culturally indoctrinate us at some point in recent history, 50, 60, 70 years ago, into an idea of normality. And normal just meant conformist. Normal became synonymous with being obedient and doing what you were told to do.
Yeah, I agree with you wholeheartedly. You know, and it's been kind of a splinter from our family, I feel like, you know. And, you know, when we walk away from mom, mm-hmm. or mom walks away from us,
mm-hmm.
that ethereal cord is still attached, you know. We're still sending energy through that space. And I think it's time as women and as fathers and, you know, to realize that, you know, we've fought for a lot of choices to not bring this life into this world. You know,
mm-hmm.
it's time to take the responsibility for making the choice to bring it into the world.
Sure.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and personal responsibility is not an easy sell. That's not an easy thing to sell to people, the idea of personal responsibility. I used to work in schools, and I always used to say to the kids in the schools, responsibility, if you break down the word, it means responsibility, your ability to respond. What is bad about having more options and your ability to respond? It just makes you a more powerful person with more capabilities and more options. Personal responsibility from that point of view, I think, is a tough sell. But if we could get over the idea to people that it's a good thing, then, you know, the world would be a better place.
For sure. Healing is a choice. It's a choice. I know for myself, like, you know, the last time I was hurt, I was 17, right? And I'm 54 now. That means I've lived, mm-hmm. you know, all these years as if I got hurt this morning.
Sure.
So it's making that choice, right, to mm-hmm. move out of the way.
And absolutely. I do think that healing is a choice, and I think that's why when people come to me and they ask me, can narcissists ever be healed? Can people who are psychopaths with antisocial personality disorder ever be healed? I'm sort of like, well, they don't want to be healed. They've not made that choice. There is a submission in that choice. There's a vulnerability, a humility in choosing to heal. And if you can't take that decision and you don't have that humility to open yourself up to being healed, then you can't be. So, yeah, I agree with you there. It is a choice.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit, you know, I know that through my journey I did a lot of studying with, you know, PTSD and CPTSD. Can you talk to us a little mm-hmm. bit about those and kind of their differences?
Sure. PTSD is the one that we're all familiar with from films. You know, if we watch a film about a Vietnam vet, I remember Tom Cruise did a film about a Vietnam vet with PTSD, Born on the 4th of July. It was a good movie.
Right.
It's the idea that, you know, singular incidents that you can remember in adulthood that were traumatic replay in the brain, and the brain and the body say, danger, 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 I'm in danger, and you will replay the incident. You know, when I was 21, I was hit in the face with a glass in a bar in England. So I had a PTSD response to that, which was I remembered being out and I remember being hit in the face and then bleeding a lot and having a lot of facial injuries. The complex PTSD is when the abuse might not be overt. It might have been covert. It might not have even been any kind of covert abuse so much as neglect. And then you have an emotional response to that. You have an emotional response to the neglect. And what you flash back to, in the PTSD, you flash back to the event, you are flashing back to the feeling. So the reason why it's complex, why we call it complex PTSD, is because it's damn complicated, and it's really it's complicated to heal as well. Because we finding the stimulus or the trigger is tough, and then dealing with and healing the response is equally difficult.
Well, and I think there's also there's the layer of the rarer pieces of the amnesia and the disassociation, right, that fall into that place.
Well, it's always a fun experience when I'm coaching somebody and I'm trying to help them resolve complex PTSD. We get to the point in the therapeutic process where we're talking about the source of their pain, and then the client just goes bang and disassociates, and they've left the room because that's their danger response. They're like, oh, shit. This is the threatening situation. This is the situation I don't want to look at. Bang, and they're just out of their bodies. They just completely dissociate.
It's kind of default, and that's really hard to heal. Yeah. You know, depending, on how early it started.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely. That then is when the trust and the bond between the coach and the client is a sacred thing. You know, it's very, very important that you have a strong rapport with that client, and that they believe that if things get out of hand, you can pull them out quickly. It's not impossible, but it is a tricky process to go through.
I know for myself, I can't really decide if I created it or I experienced it, but I had a whole nother world that I would visit. And it was very similar to this one, except people were kind, and the animals all talked. And in that space, I could grasp really what was going on and how to maneuver it when I got back.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I had similar experiences growing up, except in the case of my flights of fancy, I actually was one of the animals in that scenario,
Right.
and I was like trying to live in a world of humans, going, I can't do this, I can't communicate with these sick, horrid, perverse people.
And what was your animal?
Who've lost. It was like a four-legged, maybe somewhere between a cat and a fox kind of a creature.
Oh, interesting. You know, that's probably
about these
band
were very,
wolf,
very,
right? Is it a barred wolf?
It was really, really odd because these delusions were very, they were very strong. They were very, very, very powerful.
They were realer to me than here, because to me, here I would pinch myself to make sure.
Yes, yeah.
Because it was too crazy, right?
I think there's an emotional reality that cannot be denied here. So to this day, I would defend that and say it was as real as anything else that I experienced growing up. Because in that space, there was an emotional reality that I needed, that I was starving for, that made sense to me. And when I look back on it, I'm like, okay, it's a metaphor in which things make sense, in which things are natural, in which, you know, I was this four-legged creature that was connected to the earth and connected to my natural instincts, and there was no such thing as guilt, there was no such thing as shame, and it all sort of resonated with a Garden of Eden experience before the snake, you know, before the apple, before
Me too.
The fig leaf.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, I had a panther. I had a black panther. Oh, right. His name was Tigua. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. I could, you know, he taught me how to become him. And so, mm-hmm. and you know, that's how I would fight, you know?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, if you've got a panther standing beside you, heck, go in and kick some butt, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, this is the kind of thing that needs to be, in a coaching context, in a therapeutic context, needs to be acknowledged, valued, reconnected with, looked at, and, you know, it ties, I mean, I've always been very interested in dream psychology, and the symbols of the unconscious, and they have a reality. They are part of reality. They're not a fact. Like, the word fantasy is used dismissively nowadays. It's just a fantasy. But actually, fantasy has a reality to it.
Right. And, you know, if there, you know, quantum physics says this is only a dream, so who's to say that dream is less real than this one?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So how do you kind of view that, the difference between mental illness after your study of, you know, because I kind of did the same thing, right? I studied every religion and spiritual practice known to man, I think. Mm-hmm. And, you know, how do you see that now? Is there a line between mental illness and mystical experience for you at this point, or?
I just think a lot of it, the boundaries are very blurred for me. With all of this stuff, it's human experience. Who gets mm-hmm. to say what a mental illness is and isn't? You know, we in the world, most of us in this community, we follow America. We follow the DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistics Manual, which is created by the American Psychiatry Association, which votes on the existence of mental illnesses. So they hold a vote, and if they enough of them vote and agree that it exists, then boom, magically, the high magicians of society make it exist. And if they say it does not exist in 3 years' time, then boom, magically the high magicians of psychiatry eradicate that reality and it doesn't exist again. I mean, magic never went away. It's still here and it's still being practiced.
Right, right. It's just
so.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
You know, to answer that question, the definitions of mental illness, these are social constructs, and you know I don't necessarily consent to how they're defined and what they are. Sometimes I do. Sometimes I'll say, hey, thank you, American Psychiatry Association. That's a great definition of something that seems to occur. But to me, it's just a model of reality. It's not reality itself. So, you know, what was mentally ill in the 60s is not mentally ill today. Take the case of Rose Kennedy. John F. Kennedy's younger sister. She was a rebellious girl who spoke out in the family, wouldn't do what she was told, so they locked her up in an asylum and cut out part of her brain. they gave her a frontal lobotomy that went wrong, and she spent the rest of her life, I think, with a mental age of an 8-year-old. That happened in recent history.
Isn't that awful?
It's awful. It's horrendous. And yeah. And that happened to her because she wouldn't shut up. She was told to shut up, and she wouldn't do it. So they took her to a place where they cut people open to alter their consciousness, and they got the operation wrong, and they reduced her back to the mental age, I think, of an 8-year-old for the rest of her days. She had to live in care just because she wouldn't shut up. So when we talk about the definitions of mental illness, I always try and remind myself that's what these definitions can cause.
Right. Right. So what did your place look like that you would go to? What was it like?
You mean when I was younger? And
yeah.
Oh, there was... It was actually two-dimensional. I came away feeling like it was trying to represent another period of evolution where I was a creature, I was a simplistic animal, and I couldn't see things in 3D. I saw things in 2D, and things kind of looked like Egyptian hieroglyphs. So my reality as I looked around in that world kind of looked like two-dimensional Egyptian hieroglyphs.
Oh, that's interesting. That's really interesting.
It's weird, isn't it?
Yeah. Mine was actually really beautiful. It was a great meadow. There was a forest. You know, that's kind of was my go-to as a child was nature. And kind of this community of people that worked with me. But there was, you know, it was very beautiful, which, you know, was, you know, great contrast against, you know, my land, right?
Sure.
You had, you talk a lot about the narcissistic. Now, can you tell us a little bit, like, about what you see the difference between a narcissist and a, say, sociopath?
Okay. On having just criticized the American Psychiatry Association on this one.
I know.
I submit to them. I think that their model is accurate. And their model is that the essentially, I keep coming back to America. I'm a fan of America, though sometimes people get the impression I'm an America basher. I am not. But the model of the psychopath that we talk about now is an American social construct that came out of the desire to medicalize and clinicize, if you like, criminal behavior. So a psychopath, the easiest way to remember what a psychopath is, it's basically a description of a criminal. When we have tests for psychopaths, and you can go and find them online and even do them for free, most of those came from research and development that came out of the American justice system, the penal system, that came out of American prisons, and it was to give a cross-section of what the average prisoner looked like. So therefore, people can figure this out, it tends to be somebody with low impulse control, somebody who is a drifter, somebody who is exploitative, somebody who might be prone to violence to get what they want, but not necessarily a sadist. And the difference between the narcissist and the psychopath, the main one that I think of, is that the psychopath tends to be a loser. They tend to get caught because these are the people who are in the prison system. So they're the ones who got caught. So they tend to be self-destructive and so low disciplined and such poor self-impulse control that they actually end up in jail. The narcissist, on the other hand, if they're a functioning narcissist, they should not get caught. They should be able to carry on doing what they're doing, but not actually get caught.
You know, I know in a lot of abusive homes, there's the observer, right? The person that, you know, turns their head from what is happening in the home. And, you know, I know for myself and my clients, that is a hard place, right? That knowing that somebody has been watching, you know, this thing play out and have done nothing. Now, how would you, what would you tell your clients about that person? How to maneuver that?
I suppose, you know, we've got to look. We have a hurt. And when you have a client, and they're in pain, and maybe they've suffered abuse recently, or they've suffered some kind of trauma recently, the pain that they're experiencing is not the pain of an adult. It's the pain and vulnerability and confusion of a child. So the inner child is now wounded and present in the adult body. And the child can't understand adult concepts like, oh, this person was cowardly, this person had an agenda, this person had, they wanted to save face, they were frightened of the judgment of the community if they turned around and said, my spouse, my husband, my wife is a sexual deviant who preys on children, and they feared the inner child can't deal with that. So when I'm doing that kind of work with people, I try to address it the way that I would address speaking to a child. And really what I want to know is, how does that child inside the adult body feel about the fact that somebody knew that they were being hurt, could have stopped it, but didn't? And then I will be encouraging my client to express the feelings of abandonment and betrayal and anger and grief and sadness that they are feeling and felt as a child because of that. That's the direction I would probably go.
Yeah, that's kind of what I do too. I think that it's really difficult as an adult to face, you know, what that means as far as their family structure, you know.
Sure.
Extricating themselves from those relationships. That's, you know, again, that place of responsibility, that's a humongous choice, you know.
Yeah.
When you finally get to that point where you're like, okay, I'm just going to have to back out because that thought has not shifted in 30 years.
And that's where, when we're doing coaching work with people, you can be the adult on scene in that emotional space, because that inner child has no sense of time. There's no timeline there. It's happening now. I'm re-experiencing it emotionally now. And at the very least, we can say, hey, that was wrong. What that other adult did when they didn't save you, that was wrong. That was abuse. That was cowardice. They turned their back on you. No adult should ever turn their back on you. And give them some kind of moral foothold on the situation to actually be able to call neglect abuse. You've got to be able to call abuse abuse. If you don't,
right,
then you're open to being abused.
Right. I think it's also important to be able to totally lost it. Sorry.
It's okay.
I got caught up in your conversation. I liked you talking about the warrior. I often say that, you know, if I were going to fight a civil war, I would gather up all of us, right? Because we're going to be standing mm-hmm. tomorrow. So why don't you talk about that a little bit? I kind of liked that when I found that.
You could try and gather up all of us. I think a lot of people who have complex PTSD, who are raised in adverse childhood conditions, you're probably going to find a lot of them have found their way into the security services. You'll find lot of them are already, they'll already be working in, you know, in England. We have the MI5, in America you have the CIA, the NSA. These are people who can chameleon themselves to different cultures, who learn languages very quickly, who learn new skills very quickly, who can put aside their own sense of self-worth and personal safety for a greater cause quite willingly, because they intrinsically have a self-destructive strain inside of them. So we inadvertently, through this trauma, become very, very useful useful objects to a greater machine, sadly. Then there are others of us who go more into the therapeutic, social work, teaching kind of professions. But yeah, absolutely, it would be it would be a good thing if we could see a stronger community between people who've experienced childhood abuse and are carrying CPTSD. I think that would be a great thing to get all of these people together and communing with one another in an empathic way and supporting each other.
Yeah, because I think we can't see where we've been, right? We can't see even the accomplishments we've made. And I found with myself looking back and working with somebody that was behind me, I was like, you know, okay, I did this work in between here. I can see that I have moved in this progression. And that was a very powerful step for me as well, mm-hmm. you know, as I was walking mm-hmm. through that. So, Richard, tell us where – oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say it comes from the childhood conditioning to neglect your own needs and to not acknowledge your accomplishments, because your parents probably didn't do that for you the way that they should have done. Sorry, I interrupted you there.
Oh, no, I was going to say thank you for joining us today. You're doing some amazing work. I'm going to enjoy following you. Is there a final thought that you would like to leave with our listeners today?
I guess the final thought would be to have hope. Even though people have lived entire lifetimes and nothing that they tried in any system or any therapeutic style worked, there are great leaps forward being made in dealing with complex PTSD and childhood trauma. Hold on to some hope. You know, I got better. I recovered, and I was very, very sick, and I recovered quite well. And if I can do it, so can anybody else.
Mm. Thank you. Will you share with us how to purchase your course and the best way for people to keep in contact with you and your work?
Yeah, if they just go over to SpartanLifeCoach.com, the course is available there. We have an active Facebook group and an active YouTube as well. If you just Google Spartan Life Coach, you'll find it. And, yeah, they can keep in touch with me there if they so choose.
Oh, well, thank you so much for being with us today. I appreciate it a lot. And our listeners have a lot of info to go home and sort through. You know, we all have the ability to begin to write a new chapter and create a life that's more than merely surviving. I believe it's not only a choice, but our responsibility collectively to heal. The world needs us awake and healthy. We're the world's quiet warriors. I'd love for you guys to follow me on Facebook, Coach Sherry Doyen, Twitter, Sherry Doyen, and SherryDoyen.com. And you can tune in each and every Thursday at 5:30 Central Time at Blog Talk Radio, Untangle Your Story. Thanks for tuning in.
You have been listening to Untangle Your Story. Go beyond survival and discover the magic of thriving from childhood abuse with Sherry Doyen. All shows are archived on Blog Talk Radio and SherryDoyen.com.